Welcome to Behind the Curtain with me, Rhiannon Cars. I am absolutely chuffed a bit to welcome the brilliant Niamh McCloskey to the podcast today. Niamh is, without a doubt, one of Curtain's finest. She's a walking, talking embodiment of our values in pretty much everything she does, to be honest. She first joined us as a placement student back in 2013. And since then, she's adventured through a few of our offices, finally finding her home in Leeds, where I think it's safe to say she's absolutely thriving. She started out with us as a structural engineer, but later Niamh took a sidestep in her career to head up the sustainability arm of Curtain's. Today, she's technical associate in sustainability, and she's leading the charge on all things operational and delivery related when it comes to carbon reduction. I'd say she's what I'd call the perfect blend of data-driven precision and blue sky imagination. She's got the kind of mind that can analyse the numbers and reimagine what's possible. Yes, please. In this episode, we'll dive into her career journey. We're going to explore some of the twists that got her to where she is now and also unpack why the work that she's doing is what's so exciting. It's so forward-thinking, but quite frankly, it's essential. So let's get into it. Welcome, Niamh. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Rhi. Thank you for having me today.
No problem at all. So let's start there, shall we? So this week we're celebrating World Earth Day, which is, you know, become quite a milestone in the Curtain's calendar, actually. We've always tried to kind of, over the last couple of years, particularly since you've been in this role, kind of make a big play of it and make sure that we kind of shine in the light on it. So could you kind of take this opportunity to give us an update on our carbon targets?
Yes. So actually, 4 years ago, to the date of Earth Day was where we launched our carbon database, which is looking at project carbon emissions, predominantly structural carbon emissions, embodied carbon. Mm-hmm. So to set a bit of a scene on our reduction, that looks at about, we're currently at about 500 data points of our structural projects across the business. That varies from new build construction to refurbishment projects. And in 2022, we took an average of that data and set a baseline of what our carbon emissions were for projects. And we used that as a point to set our reduction, take mm-hmm. responsibility for the embodied carbon emissions that we were creating through our design decisions and the materials that we were specifying. And we committed to 15% reduction in embodied carbon emissions by 2030. Mm-hmm. And quite a lot of the time you will see externally lots of businesses making commitments for reducing their embodied carbon emissions by about 50%. And it's important to note that we committed to 15%, not 50, because of it. We wanted a realistic target. We wanted a target that was achievable through what we have in control at Curtain's. So recognizing that there is no legislation in embodied carbon. We don't necessarily work with clients that prioritize it. And yeah, it's what's in our control through mainly the materials we specify mm-hmm. and the way that we design. Mm-hmm. So in 2025, we did a review. So we do review annually, but in 2025, we took the milestone of reporting what our reduction has been to date. And that was around 11%. So by 2025, we've already achieved an 11% reduction in Incredible. Our embodied carbon emissions. So you can probably associate around 4 to 5% of that to efficiencies in the industry. So some materials are being made more efficient, the grid is getting greener, and some clients will have legislation and some kind of like public sector bodies. Mm-hmm. So the remainder of that is through the kind of hard work that people have delivered in Curtain's, through prioritizing it in their designs, through considering it through their designs mm-hmm. and advocating with clients. So that would, if we did project that forward, that would put us about 28% by 2030 if we carried on the same trajectory. So then operationally, obviously slightly different scale of emissions. As a business, we recognise that it's not only our projects we work on, we have a responsibility in the way that we run our business to, you know, say what we preach with sustainability in our projects. We, you know, we want to embed that through our business culture as well. Mm-hmm. So we have been tracking our operational carbon emissions each year. And last year we had about 6% reduction in our operational carbon emissions. And we saw some really great things where we were increasing significantly the miles that we drive as a business in electric vehicles compared to fossil fuel vehicles. Mm-hmm. Lots more active travel through our business for commuting and business travel. And next steps is really looking at our supply chain and the scope 3 emissions that we have.
Yeah, I mean, what I've really sort of noticed in the business in the last couple of years is the kind of desire, you know, this kind of, I think some people have perhaps woken up to it and to making those different choices. Some people have actually been driving it from a personal perspective for a long, long time and have really kind of, in the shift that they've seen within the business, had that opportunity to go, oh, okay, I can embrace this now. I can embrace it in my day-to-day design. I can embrace it in the way that we kind of, like you say, the way that we go about our day-to-day roles within, you know, the travel that we take and that sort of thing. And I think there just seems to be a kind of, I don't know, just from people across the business, this real drive actually to push it forward.
Yeah, I've seen so much incredible engagement and nearly every sort of discipline or role within Curtin's trying to bring it into their role and how they can have their own impact. We see it from marketing and events that we do, but then we also see it at a project level or people who run offices and the way that offices are run, or even through like community engagement. In the last couple of years, we've seen a massive boom in people doing litter picks with their office, community gardens, tree planting, with their volunteering time. Whereas previously, that wasn't something that we'd really seen a lot of. But yeah, there's been lots of so much incredible engagement. Everything I do relies on the work of other people. Mm-hmm. And we really wouldn't be achieving this sort of reduction if it wasn't for people within the business really making it a priority.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, some of those examples that you've listed there, like I know from the marketing team, for example, you know, in some ways it's quite achievable. It's quite easy. You kind of look around and you make sure that you're identifying those suppliers that are ethical and that they do kind of provide those sustainable choices for us to, you know, for our events and things like that. But ultimately, the big challenge for us, I suppose, is within the embodied carbon, isn't it? And the, you know, it's one of the biggest contributors to global emissions is the construction industry, isn't it? So I think that's where we really kind of get squeezed. But what do you think would be the biggest challenge, or what are the biggest challenges for our industry and kind of making a meaningful impact on that?
So something I mentioned when we were setting our targets is the lack of legislation.
Yeah.
So legislation that lots of people have opinions on, but one thing that limiting carbon through legislation does is it makes it a priority for people who aren't necessarily considering it currently. It creates a market for low carbon technologies and low carbon projects. It almost forces that market that maybe currently isn't there. And yeah, it really forces it to be a priority and to be considered in a design. We've seen lots of powerful volunteer standards where like the net zero carbon building standard and a couple of public sector frameworks where they do set embodied carbon limits. And that really changes the trajectory of embodied carbon being considered in design. So straight away at the start of a project, we need to consider, can we achieve these targets? What design decisions do we make to achieve those limits? And until there's kind of a government standard, we won't see that really making a big impact unless it's across all sectors and, yeah, at that higher level. Mm-hmm. Then the second probably thing is the access to innovative materials and scalable sort of technologies. I think the iStruct estimates that we can only reduce up to 50% of emissions through design decisions alone. The remainder of the 50% needs to be done through innovation into like digital technologies in carbon and sustainability, material innovation, and then also into things like carbon capture and storage. But one of the biggest barriers is the access to scalable innovation. So, for example, there might be lots going on at universities, but us at project level don't have the foresight of that. We don't have the access to that. And also many of them aren't scalable for the size of actual UK construction projects. So that's quite a big limit to how far some of this can go.
Yeah.
But this is where legislation would almost like drive that market for those technologies to come into.
Yeah, and I suppose when you mentioned at the beginning, you know, these businesses that are kind of projecting these 50% targets, for example, like until some of these things come in, it's almost impossible to achieve that level, isn't it, of reduction?
Yeah, 50% reduction at the minute, based on our database that we've referenced, we only see those sort of limits of carbon really on refurbishment projects. Mm-hmm. So if we were to commit to that level of reduction, we would need to be only working on refurbishment projects, for example, or projects where, yeah, there is the blue sky thinking, but mm-hmm. that just isn't the way our industry currently works. We still are quite traditional. So yeah, we've got, there's a bit of work in the industry to get to that point, but yeah, legislation would really help that.
I can see how it would really propel things, because at the end of the day, the industry, much like many others actually, but it does move quite slowly, doesn't it, in terms of adopting change. And we've seen that, you know, it does adopt change, but it can be a bit of a tanker sometimes. But I think that what happens when you see these legislation kind of being introduced is it kind of overnight accelerates that, doesn't it?
Yeah, and we see things like, even through the way we developed things in curtains, things work where you have passionate people advocating at one level, but then you also have the kind of like high level mandatory requirements, and together that's how it makes change. But sometimes when it's only the people at the advocacy level, it can limit how far it can go and what the impact can be made. Yeah, that's kind of where you'd hope things are going. We do see clients bringing it in, prioritising. There was a really brilliant standard, which is a volunteer standard, called the Net Zero Carbon Building Standard. Mm-hmm. And that sets targets each year for embodied carbon, operational carbon, and water use. And it reduces every single year to 2030. And there's a number of really big clients, funders, banks, contractors who have committed to basically using this standard within their projects. So hopefully, that's just released its first version about a month ago. So hopefully we'll start to see some projects come through curtains, which will be working to that standard.
Yeah. And I suppose what that does as well is it really illustrates that kind of appetite from, like you say, enormous businesses who actually do have that might, as well as the mid-sized ones, a little bit more like curtains, to, and that's often when you see this shift, isn't it, from kind of central government in terms of those legislations being introduced, when actually you see there's a real drive for it, and almost the industry's picking it up and running with it itself.
Yeah, and the standards are written, so you know, the legislation could, you know, adopt the policies that are being written and volunteered by through the UK construction industry. But yeah, there's definitely a big appetite. I think people are just a little bit wary how, you know, when it's still at volunteer level.
I mean, you've talked us through kind of some of the challenges there, which are very real, aren't they? But I'd love to hear, I suppose, the flip side of that. What excites you? What can you see kind of coming down the road over the next 12 months or so? And you think, okay, this is really going to propel us.
So probably for me, one of the most exciting things in the next 12 months and beyond, at Curtains, we have two new roles in innovation and digital transformation, Mark and Sophie, who are working looking at how we transform our digital space, but also then how, as Curtains, we are involved in innovation and those opportunities. Mm-hmm. And I think, for one, the digital transformation, what we could do with our carbon data, the data that we could gather from all of our models, our Revit models, I think that's really exciting. Yeah. We could excel what we're doing with our carbon data at the minute, going beyond potentially just looking at measuring reduction. We could start to forecast reduction where we're modelling different situations. Yeah. We could be looking at, okay, well, if the UK construction sector doesn't decarbonise, how does that affect our data going forward? And lots of exciting things like that. But then also Mark's role in innovation gives us access to that, you know, the limits that we were talking about us having foresight of technologies that are out there, mm-hmm, the research mm-hmm. that's going on. Mark's role will give us those opportunities to see those technologies, speak to those innovators, and hopefully bring those into Curtains. We are on the brink, hopefully, of being part of quite an industry-leading initiative, which will look at innovation in low-carbon concrete. So watch this space, because that could really sort of put us at the forefront within our projects of mm-hmm. looking at novel materials.
I mean, I sort of feel that, you know, in my experience at Curtains, there are certain roles that we introduce into the business, and they're kind of like a moment in time, and there's almost, you see the world before and after that role was introduced, because it really shakes things up. It really, really impacts how we do things around here, and I think your role is absolutely an example of one of those, the before and after we had that in place. And I think Mark and Sophie's is another, and I can really see, you know, I'm pretty excited about the idea of you guys working together and where that could take us. I'm excited about that. I can imagine. Yeah, I can really see why you would be as well.
Yeah, it's opened doors for me that I didn't even think were possible for us to do in sustainability at Curtains and just in the industry. So yeah, really exciting. And just happening so fast as well.
Yeah.
When you have motivated people, things really can start to move pretty quickly, which, you know, have felt so far away before.
Yeah, absolutely. It's such a catalyst, isn't it? You know, that passionate individual. And then I think if you kind of combine that with the support of a business and the experience that's kind of wrapped around that as well, then it's something pretty powerful, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm going to move us on then to think about kind of specific sectors, I suppose. So a big area of focus for university estates in particular is decarbonising their facilities. And often that's looking at reusing existing buildings and I suppose considering that from both the carbon and the cost perspective. I'd love to hear what your reflections are on retrofitting, refurbing those existing buildings. You know, when we're thinking about delivering those net zero carbon ambitions, what work can Curtains do, I suppose, to help achieve that?
So we see across a lot of our university clients that they all have sustainability policies and sustainability plans going through their kind of like estates and their assets that they own. And a large number of those do prioritise reuse of existing structures and refurbishment over new builds. And we know university estates have lots of either culturally significant buildings or lots of buildings that have been there for quite a long time. And at Curtains, one of the kind of design ethics that we have tried to embed through our engineers is looking at the design hierarchy for net zero. And on the biggest section of that, and the first section you consider, is to use less stuff in the first place. So how can we build nothing or build less with what we already have? Which can sometimes be a little bit controversial to say to a room full of people who build things for a living.
Yeah.
But one of the biggest things about using less is it doesn't mean that there's no skill and engineering involved. In fact, many people listening,
It's the opposite. Mm-hmm.
The most difficult projects they might have worked on, which needed the most amount of kind of like engineering skill, is the refurbishment projects and working out what a building is designed to do. Mm-hmm. And at Curtains, we have a lot of skill in terms of like looking at existing assets, how they can be reused, how they can be changed of use, how they can be repaired. You know, helping clients to basically forward plan what they have, what the kind of like asset strategy of repair and replacement would be. In terms of our carbon data and reducing carbon, in terms of the further education sector, so looking at universities, we have seen that our data basically shows you can have about an 80% reduction in embodied carbon if you refurbish a building rather than building new.
Gosh, that's so significant, isn't it?
Yeah, and obviously it depends on sector, but that's our data for universities. And also, when we think about reuse and retrofit and circular economy, it's not always just about using an asset as it is. If a client, for example, decides that, you know, this building isn't currently going to work for what our plan is, and it, you know, demolition or taking a building down is the only kind of option that they have, it's about how we can encourage reuse of those elements and how those elements can be put back into the system rather than go into like landfill. So assessing the opportunities for, you know, how it could be circular and reused, maybe not in situ in terms of the building as it is.
Yeah. And you're seeing that being embraced then by those clients.
Yeah. So there's a really exciting reuse of steel market, and it's something that I had seen in some traditional projects when I very first started at Curtains, where clients were, you know, quite cost savvy, where they were taking down buildings and reusing the materials just because they were, we own those materials, why wouldn't we reuse them? But it's being completely reframed now in terms of like the carbon impacts of that and reusing and seeing buildings almost like as a carbon bank, not just a cost bank.
Yeah, it's a different way of talking about that value, isn't it?
Yeah, so we've had some quite exciting projects, particularly in our Cardiff office, where they're looking at reusing steel. So almost like purchasing steel that has been taken down from a deconstructed building and being put into a new building. So we had a project where they saved about, I think they used about 35 tons of reclaimed steelwork in a sports hall.
Goodness me.
So yeah, it's quite exciting.
So it's not just the building that's being reused, it's using that, like you say, as the bank of materials as well.
Yeah.
And how cool is that to be able to take the story of those materials as well, like into a new lease of life?
We're in not just a climate emergency, but also a resource scarcity. Of course, yeah. And it's quite a privileged position to be able to just knock buildings down whenever we want to, because they don't fit maybe an aesthetic you know, we just want something a bit shinier. And I think it's around 50,000 buildings are demolished every year in the UK, which is a phenomenal amount of resource. Yeah. And yeah, how can those 50,000 buildings be kept in the system rather than landfill or imported away? So yeah, that would be also of quite an exciting opportunity that we can move into when we're doing our existing building surveys and things.
I mean, that's so fascinating. You're clearly kind of, I don't know, your perspective, your outlook is really shaped by the work that you're doing around carbon reduction. But I'd really like to hear about, I suppose, the earlier parts of your career and maybe how it started, how you found yourself where you are now, how it's shaped perhaps by your personal passion. So moving from graduate engineer and then eventually into kind of sustainability, what made this like the right choice for you, and how did you get there?
So I started at Curtin's probably, I think it's like 12 or 13 years ago, as a student in the Liverpool office.
I checked, it was 13.
13. I can't believe how fast it's gone. Right. And I actually started working with Anthony Clarke in the conservation and heritage sort of buildings. And then I moved to work with John Kelly and Dave Jones in the Liverpool CNS teams. And I loved it. I did summers and wherever I could, basically working with Curtin's, and I just had such a great time. And when I graduated university, I started as a graduate engineer again in the Liverpool office. And those people that have known me these 13 years will always have known I was a bit of a preacher in my personal life about sustainability. I had made a lot of personal sacrifices and changes to the way that I lived, and I hadn't really ever considered what my professional impact would be. So I always considered my personal impact, but I never really considered my professional impact. And I did quite a lot of external work with the Institution of Structural Engineers. I chaired their young members panel, I sat on the council, and then I began basically a role on their climate steering group. So this group basically steers the direction of the Institution of Structural Engineers. An example of that would be, we changed the exam. So the 7.5-hour exam that everybody hears about when you want to become professionally qualified, we changed the exam to include embodied carbon calculations and advocating for reuse. So quite big changes. And what that kind of opened doors for me was, the opportunities to be part of like technical standards, championing innovation in sustainability. It was great. And it also meant that I could bring a lot of that back to Curtin's. And I think Curtin's had also recognised with Stephen Beggs that we needed an opportunity for somebody to really lead sustainability as a full-time job. So the opportunity came up in Curtin's for, working full-time in sustainability. And luckily I got that job, and I'm forever grateful for the opportunity to kind of change careers, because I feel like a fire has been lit in my belly. Mm-hmm. Like I really feel fulfilled and passionate about my work. Mm-hmm. I get to be really, I feel a strong sense of purpose within my job. And also it was very different going from a technical project delivery role, working in a structural delivery team, to then being a central role and sort of on my own. But now I work with so many incredible, inspiring people across the business, which I never would have had the opportunity to work with before. Mm. It's not just technical disciplines. I work with so many central roles across Curtin's. And it's just been probably one of the best things I ever did. And it did take quite a lot of confidence, because you know what you knew before.
Leap of faith, absolutely.
I'd always seen my work following a traditional kind of structure. But I started to get that itch, and I knew that I wanted something different. I wanted a bit of a different career route. And it made sense. And it's, been one of the best things I ever did.
Yeah, sounds like there's no regrets.
No, I absolutely, I love it. I love my job, which is a very lucky thing.
It is, and it is, and it's something that you want for everybody, don't you? Like, how wonderful to be able to feel that sense of fulfillment, to be able to have that strong purpose in what you're doing. And I think the alignment between your, you know, your personal passions and motivators with your kind of professional one is an incredible space to be working in, and kind of makes coming to work every day, I suppose, worth it, doesn't it? You have a little girl, Nora, now. And I think, you know, when we think about coming into work, it does shift, doesn't it, when you become a parent. And I've had that experience as well. And actually, I think being able to come to a job that you feel so passionate about, and when you're leaving children at home, actually, is an amazing space to be able to be in. But talk us through, what would you, I don't know how much you think about this, but the future for Nora, what would you love that to look like? Or I suppose, what lessons have you learned professionally or personally that you'd like to pass on to her?
Yeah, so I don't think anyone could have prepared me for the emotional and shift that I've had since returning to work after having a baby. And just, I feel very different, but I actually feel more motivated than I probably was before. I talk a lot in my presentations about the next generation, and when we're talking about reducing emissions and who we're affecting, it's that next generation of people. And now I have the next generation. Yeah. that the person that I'm talking about is my daughter and potentially her children. And, you know, I can see a direct link of the people that my decisions are affecting, which I didn't have before. Mm-hmm. And Nora might ask me one day what my role was in terms of the climate emergency and what I did. And I want to be able to tell her something that she's proud of, that she sees as a role model, for example. Mm-hmm. I want her to challenge me as well. I really hope that for her future, you know, she's in a world where, in terms of sustainability, that everything she does, nature and the planet are considered as a stakeholder. I want her to love nature and have access to all of the incredible things that the world has. But I always hope that she kind of challenges what her impact is and thinks about it while she does whatever she does in the future. And hopefully, by the time she's kind of my age and in a career, that the industries see nature and the planet very differently and as a stakeholder. On a personal level, obviously she's a little girl, and I feel a sense of pressure almost for that, to that she almost doesn't feel the way I might have felt throughout my kind of like development and career, where I might have felt that I had to fit a certain stereotype or a certain box. Or, you know, she's already very wild and confident, which I absolutely love and want to nourish.
Yes, please, more of that.
Yeah. And I hope she doesn't ever feel that being loud means that she's seen as aggressive, or the stereotypes we hear about, you know, I want her to challenge people and not feel that she can't speak up. So, yeah, I hope she's always can feel that she can be her true self.
Be her true self, absolutely. And I mean, I suppose my reflection on that, Niamh, would be she has such a wonderful role model in seeing you as somebody who does challenge the status quo, who doesn't just accept what is there. But there's a way to do that as well, right? There's a way to show how that can be done. And I think that I can imagine that, you know, she's grown up and she might not be able to kind of like communicate it yet, but absolutely I can imagine there's a world where she brings that. She brings that through, and maybe even into the construction industry. How cool would that be? I mean, what do you think that the construction industry, thinking on that, what do you think the construction industry could and should be doing to support women more into those technical roles, whether that's Nora or my kids or whoever else it may be?
Yeah, so I was heavily influenced by my mum. My mum worked in a chemical plant. She's a professional CrossFitter. She always has shaped to me what a challenge in stereotypes looks like. And I was always exposed to a very, you know, wonderful role model in my mum. But in work, for me, I now look to role models who are successful women in leadership, but those who have boundaries as well, and might, you know, setting out of office on a Friday, which says, I don't work a Friday because I spend time with my children, which might not have been a kind of role model I was looking for 2-3 years ago, but the current point in my life, like, I want to see people who have a good work-life balance, but are still leaders and are still seen as experts in their field. I think it's really important that women are made to feel it's inclusive. The culture that we work in our industry can often feel slightly uninclusive from the events that we have to go to networking events, those kind of things, often on an evening. I'm currently not in the position where I feel like I want to spend my evenings, you know, I want to be with my daughter and I want to do bedtime. Peer-to-peer support. I didn't quite imagine how I would feel returning to work the way that I do. Just lost a bit of confidence, and I really found comfort in talking to people with shared experiences, people that had gone through the same sort of thing as me in the last year or 2 years, and, you know, understanding that the way I felt was actually completely normal.
Of course.
And I couldn't have prepared myself any more than I did before. But yeah, ensuring that people can see people that look like them, but also having access to the peer support, the you know, community of people going through similar things.
I 100% hear you on that, and I think that I think it's amazing when you do have women around you, strong women around you, who have those shared experiences. And I would, I'd also add that I think that there's a role for men in that as well. And I think it can, in some ways, be more impactful when you see, you know, a male colleague who says, "Right, I don't work a Friday because I'm spending time with my kids," as well as the women saying that. And I always advocate for, you know, kind of particularly male members of the board and some of those most senior roles, to say it loudly, you know, like, and don't underestimate the impact that that can have, absolutely, on women in the business, on men in the business, but I suppose just more broadly on that culture, that that work-life balance and who you are in work is not the sole purpose of your existence. And that that cultural shift that we're still, I think we've seen a bit of it, but we've still got a way to go. I think it's fundamental for that next generation coming through and their experiences.
I think people think of work completely different now. It's like they want a good work-life balance, and you can see that cultural shift happening. And I have a great manager at Curtin's, Paul Menzies, and he's not just checked in on me in terms of like my work deliverables. He has given me a lot of time to check in emotionally how I've been doing, and reflecting on his own experiences with his partner and his children, and you know, giving me that sort of shared experience as well. So yeah, part of the peer-to-peer support has been talking to other women who have returned from a career break and how they felt. But yeah, it also has been through shared experiences through other types of colleagues.
And don't underestimate as well, like, I don't want to speak for Paul, but whilst you'll get something from that conversation and you feel that that support from him as a manager is very kind of tangible, he'll probably get something from it as well, you know, like, for Paul it's lovely to be able to speak about, like you say, his partner and his girls, and I think actually just having those, being able to turn up as your absolute, your whole self, feeling that you belong, like, everybody gets something from those conversations, don't they?
And I'm someone who's never been able to not be myself at work, so everything I do,
amen to that.
I am Neve through and through in every aspect, so I wouldn't be able to maybe really hold back my personal feelings at work or like my personal life. It's a big part of who I am, and it's going to affect how I work and things. So yeah, I'm very grateful for the support I've had in this like sort of new chapter.
Absolutely. And I suppose now you probably feel as well a sense of like, I don't know, being able to pass that on. And I think that our experiences shape other people's, don't they? When we perhaps become those supporting systems. And I think that it's really nice to know that you're in a position now already where you'll be sharing your experience with other people in the business.
Yeah, I look to people who went through this before me and I think, oh, you went through this and I had no idea how it felt. And I had no idea what I was probably like expecting of you at work, maybe as a manager or as a colleague. So yeah, it's been a shift, and I can't expect to fit in the same shaped box that I was before. I have different priorities in the best way.
Neve, I'm going to move us on then to our kind of quick fire questions. Don't know if you think these too much, but I would love you to talk us through your favorite project that you've been involved with.
So it's been quite a while since I've obviously been in like a project delivery, and I don't necessarily have a favorite project specific, but I definitely have a favorite project type. So I did, not to like feed the agenda that I've obviously talked about, but I loved refurbishment projects, and part of that was because I felt like an engineering detective. I'm trying to work out what somebody else has designed, how a building works where you don't have much information about, and also the access that I had to surveying and seeing buildings that the general public never had access to. when I worked in Liverpool, we surveyed a 1950s Tate and Lyle sugar silo.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah,
but it's one of the original in-situ concrete arch structures. So when you look at it, yeah, it's an engineering marvel, really, as a industrial building. Mm-hmm. And it's something no one really gets access to. And I loved that part of like refurbishment and reuse projects.
And I'm sure that does shape then what you went on to do later on in your career as well.
Yeah, and I probably revalue those buildings differently, because when I worked on them, it wasn't necessarily from a sustainability perspective. It was just from a love of existing buildings.
Absolutely. So taking us to kind of weekend Niamh then, what does your ideal weekend look like?
So I am based in Leeds, so it would probably be a long kind of like country walk in the Dales with my dog and my family.
Lovely.
But then my alternative would probably be Glastonbury or a weekend like that.
And you've taken Nora to Glastonbury, haven't you?
Yeah, I took a 8-month-old baby to Glastonbury, and yeah, she's done cooler things than I ever had, probably.
Perfect. Thinking back to kind of like younger Niamh starting out in her career, have you got any advice? Like, what would you say to a younger version of yourself?
I mean, I'd probably echo some of the stuff I reflected on with Nora, but yeah, always to be my authentic self, trying not to be anybody else but who Niamh is. Mm-hmm. And then also probably not to worry as much. I've always been a worrier, and actually everything has turned out exactly how it was meant to, and pretty good. So yeah, not to worry as much.
Yeah. And maybe that's something that, like, I don't know, think about the kind of 20 years from now, Niamh. Maybe think about like what she would say to you, and you know, not to worry too much, and taking that into the next sort of couple of decades.
Yeah, I could probably do with some of my own advice.
Yeah. We're always the last ones to take our own advice, aren't we? Okay, final question then, Niamh. We ask this to all of our guests. I want you to think about you a year from now. What will you be doing? What will life look like for you?
So in terms of work, hopefully I'll be sat here telling you that we've hit over 600 carbon uploads.
Yes,
and
yes,
that
please.
We have projects in the pipeline that are really using some really cool materials or doing something differently in terms of sustainability. Business-wise, I really hope that we've started to decarbonize our supply chain, the people that we work with around our business scope of emissions. And then personally, probably just seeing the world with my daughter and showing her the wonderful UK sights and just enjoying life with her, really.
Sounds perfect. What an amazing year it's going to be, I'd say. Thank you so much for joining us, Niamh. It's been brilliant to chat to you today.
Thank you for having me.